Cut me some slack. I've been writing nonstop for days. I'm trying to finish a book. You should be happy. Yeah, the book. Actually, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. He tapped his toe as if he really didn't have time for the house call. Can I come in? Sure. Sam pushed the front door open wider, stepping aside to let him by.
No, what are you doing? Don't let him in.
The moment Eli was inside, Sam knew it was a mistake. His brow furrowed farther. His eyes scanned the room with a horrible mixture of shock and disgust. Sam had been so consumed with his novel that he hadn't bothered to take a really good look at the place. Now, through Eli's eyes, he saw it. Drinking glasses, half full of unidentifiable liquid, sat perched on end tables, on bookshelves, on the stairs. Dirty plates crusted with food were placed on the floor as if to be cleaned by a dog he did not own. Discarded clothes were draped over the banister, over lampshades, in dank, mildewing piles, a mass grave of unwashed laundry. There was an identifiable trail, clear of debris, leading from the kitchen to the computer desk, then around in a lazy arc to the staircase. Instinctively, Sam began to snatch up the rubbish, knowing he was only making the situation worse.
What in the hell is going on here, Sam?
Eli's tone was cold, the accusation unmistakable. What is wrong with you?
I told you, I've been writing. Looks like that's all you've been doing. Have you even showered lately?
Sam's skin prickled as a furious anger gripped him.
Eli, what the hell do you want?
Eli took a half step back. He offered up an apologetic smile, sensing that he was pushing Sam close to the edge.
Let's have a beer, he said.
Sam did not respond.
Come on.
Eli nodded toward the kitchen doorway.
Go grab a couple beers. Something local and undrinkable. Let's you and me sit outside and talk.
The spring air was cool with just a hint of the humidity that would weigh down the summer to come. A gentle breeze from the north brought with it the earthy scent of the Kansas River half a mile away. Sam sipped his beer in silence, trying to keep his attention on the vagueness of the quiet street he lived on. Eli turned his beer bottle around in his hands. He had yet to take a drink.
You don't return my calls? You don't respond to my emails or texts? Sam, I'm worried about you.
Don't be, Sam said, running a hand through greasy hair that had sprouted uncut into a 4-inch mop.
But look at you. You're a mess. Your house is a disaster area. What's going on, man?
For a moment, Sam thought he heard a noise. The whisper of voices. The sound of charred hands twisted by fire into claws, fumbling with the knob of the front door.
Go away, his mind pleaded. Leave me alone.
And then that inevitable thought returned to him.
Your mind is the problem. It's all finally caught up to you. You're cracking up, and you can't be fixed.
Sam?
Everything's fine. I'm just anxious to finish the book.
Tell me about it.
I told you this last fall, Eli. I don't have an outline. It's just sort of pouring out of me.
Then tell me about what you have so far.
His mouth opened, his lips preparing to curve around the words, but the explanation abandoned him. The past 6 months were a blur. He remembered only the parade of words across the computer screen, pushing blindly forward, forging ahead into uncharted waters. He had never stopped to sum up the plot into anything resembling a pitch.
It's about a house, he said finally. A house with a strange and mysterious past. A family moves in, thinking it will be the start of a new life, only the house begins to feed off of them, manipulating them, forcing them to do drastic and terrible things. Except for one, the youngest daughter. She senses the evil and delves into the house's past, trying to find a way to stop it. Eventually, her search leads her to the bedroom on the third floor. There's just one problem.
Eli leaned forward in his chair, picking up the thread without a pause.
She can't get in, because the door has been sealed by a wall, a brick wall. And the more she tries to tear down that wall, the more those around her become affected by the evil.
Sam stared at Eli, mouth agape, head cocked curiously to the side.
That's right.
He almost whispered the words.
How could you know that?
Eli stood and walked the length of the front porch, his thumb tracing the lip of the beer bottle as he tried to find the perfect words. It was obvious this was the reason for his unexpected visit.
About a week ago, I spoke to Dale Summers at Canyon.
You called my publisher?
No, he called me. Canyon just acquired Brute Force Press, which you'd probably know if you didn't have your head buried in a Word doc. Brute Force has published the last three books by T.C. Moore. Summers was worried about Moore. He hadn't heard from her in weeks. She wasn't returning his calls. She wasn't returning anyone's calls. So he wondered if I could ask you to try to contact her. I told him I was having the same problem with you. I asked Summers what Moore was working on, and after some prodding, he read me a short outline she'd given him back in November. It's very similar to yours, Sam.
How similar? Sam asked.
I mean, the characters are different. You deal with a small-town family, whereas Moore's main characters are young and brutal 20-somethings. But for all intents and purposes, the two of you are basically writing the same book.
This can't be happening, his mind screamed. How is that even possible?
Sam's voice was barely a whisper. Eli set the beer down on the porch railing and shrugged.
Look, it makes sense. Obviously, Kill Creek inspired both books. The house, the supernatural legacy, the bricked-off doorway. I mean, it's odd that they're as similar as they are, but it's not impossible that, creatively, you would find yourselves going down the same path. What worries me is how this process is affecting you personally. And if Moore has gone off the grid too, I can only assume she's become consumed with her book, just like you.
Sam thought of all the voicemails on his phone, the missed calls. He thought of his lost job at the university, and of the disastrous meeting with Aaron. The gravity of the situation perched on Sam's shoulders. A fat, gluttonous bird digging its black talons into him, all the way to the bone. In his mind, he pictured the small city of paper that awaited him inside the house, towers of 8x11 pages stacked clumsily about every room. If Moore truly was writing the same book, then all of his work was for nothing. Sam gave a sharp, humorless laugh. There was nothing to say.
You might want to try getting in touch with Moore yourself, Eli suggested. See if she'll talk to you. You have her number?
Sam nodded and looked down at his beer. Wainwright had given them each other's contact information a few days after they returned from Kill Creek. It was given under the pretense of keeping in touch, although Wainwright suggested they might want to let Daniel know they were thinking of him. Sam hadn't bothered to call or email Daniel. He just didn't know what to say. Nothing could make things better for Slaughter.
I'm sorry, Sam, but I have to fly back this evening,
Eli said. He crouched down so that he was at eye level with Sam.
Do me a favor. Take a break from the book. Shower, shave, clean up the place. And call Moore. Find out if there's any way to salvage what you're working on. Okay?
Yeah, Sam replied. Okay. Eli gave him a pat on the knee.
Take care of yourself, Sam.
Sam nodded. He watched as Eli walked down his porch steps and onto the front walk. Halfway to where his rental car was parked at the curb, the agent turned around and called back,
And answer your goddamn phone from now on.
Eli did not wait for Sam to respond. He climbed into the rental car, fired up the engine, and drove away. Sam closed his eyes and held his head in his hands. He listened to the afternoon breeze blowing through the budding limbs of trees. Somewhere down the block, a child shrieked happily. Sam focused on the sound of his own breathing, the slow draw of breath in and out of his lungs. Beside him, the doorknob jiggled. Sam sucked in a sharp breath. He could taste smoke. It bit harshly into the back of his throat. Cautiously, he got up from his chair and inched toward the door. He took hold of the knob, wincing when he heard the latch withdraw. With a sharp shove, he threw the door open, fully expecting it to collide with a misshapen form on the other side. The door swung open, fast and free, bouncing roughly off the adjoining wall. There was nothing there. Only his empty house and the mountains of poorly stacked paper that had come to represent an isolated life. Sam minimized his Microsoft Word document and opened his internet browser. A wall of favorite sites appeared. He clicked on Facebook and searched for T.C. Moore. If she had a personal account, a simple search of her name did not reveal it. There was, however, an official author page. Sam clicked on it and scrolled down. The images displayed were classic Moore, a mix of sex and violence meant to disturb. The last post was from November. She had shared the link to the RightWire video. Sam noted the number of views listed under the video. Over 600,000 people had watched the video on Moore's Facebook alone. "Christ," Sam said under his breath. He hadn't even bothered to watch it. There were a few more posts from Moore after the RightWire link, random plugs for past novels. The last post was an ambiguous message to her fans. Working on something new. After this, there was nothing. Sam opened a new tab and directed the browser to Instagram. A quick search brought up the real T.C. Moore. The experience was similar. Dark, morbid photos mixed with artistic shots of her books and selfies that sold her power and sexuality. Just like on Facebook. The posts became less and less frequent through the first 2 weeks of November. Then, nothing. Twitter showed the same results. Even online fights with haters, which apparently had been a favorite pastime of Moore's leading up to October, ceased once her feed hit the middle of November. Sam sat at the desk for a long time, pondering his next move. He could email her, but something told him he would get the same radio silence as her agent. His finger moved to the laptop's power button and paused, hovering. Sam stared at the computer screen. At the bottom, his novel, his 1,000-plus-page magnum opus, was represented by a small, minimized document icon. He could expand it and keep working. He could try to press forward. Or he could do as Eli suggested. He could take a break. "It won't like that," his mind warned him. "It won't let you rest until you're back at that keyboard." "There is no it," he said to the empty room. "It is all in your head because you've gone goddamn insane." Unless Eli was right and the same thing was happening to Moore. Then I wouldn't be crazy. I couldn't be right. That would be proof. Proof of what? His mind asked. Sam didn't know. Part of him was afraid to know. The computer gave a final disapproving beep as he pressed and held the power button. The procedure was far easier than he had expected. The hum of the laptop ceased, the glow of the monitor went dark, and that was that. He took a long, indulgent shower, letting the scalding hot water pour over his weary body. Once he was in bed, the lamp on the nightstand clicked off, the darkness settling upon him like a dense black blanket. The confusion of the day's events came rushing back to him. His book, the one thing, the only thing that gave him a sense of purpose, was in danger of fizzling out before he could even light the fuse. He had to be sure. Which was why, in the morning, he would book a flight to Los Angeles. He would go to see Moore in person. The only way for Sam to put this beast to bed would be to see the pages of Moore's manuscript with his own eyes.
And if they're the same?
He wasn't sure what he would do. He was too invested in his book. He couldn't just scrap it. Maybe there was a way to salvage what he had. In the meantime, Sam would put the book on hold. He would stop writing. Cold turkey. Just like that. No sooner had this thought flitted through his mind than the scent of burning flesh filled his bedroom. Sam's flesh prickled. He held his breath, refusing to acknowledge the smell. For a moment, only the steady tick of the clock on the wall filled the room. Then came the sound. A wheezing sound. Someone having trouble breathing. Someone in pain.
"It's coming for you!"
his mind screamed.
"Because you stopped. Because you've given up on the story."
Sam trained his eyes on the open doorway, peering into the blackness. A shape slipped through, dark and hunched. Every now and again it caught the moonlight, and in those horrible, brief moments, Sam imagined he could see a face. Its mouth pulled tight in a jagged sneer, its eyes wild and mad. And then the black of night would wash over the image like a midnight wave, lost to darkness. Something snapped, like a fingernail bent quickly backward. The shape began to drag its bulk toward his bed. The odor of burning flesh was overpowering.
"It's her,"
his mind told him.
"It's her. She knows what you did."
"It's not real," Sam said under his breath. He rolled over to the edge of the mattress, propping himself up with one hand, while reaching for the lamp with the other. His entire being cried out for him to stop, to not look at what was waiting for him in the dark, to not shed light on a thing he could never forget.
"It's all in your head. It's all in your head. It's not real."
The wave of night receded once more, and the face was staring up at him, body hunched down on the floor, head cocked, sunken cheek pressed against the side of the mattress, teeth clenched in a lipless grin. He clicked on the lamp. In an instant, the 60-watt bulb pushed back the darkness, an orb of luminance warming the room. The creature did not vanish in the light. The face peered up, burned beyond recognition. The back of its skull was caved in. It reached up with a charred black finger.
"You did this. You did this to me. You did this."
Sam pressed his eyes shut.
"No. Stop. You did this to me. Stop, 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 stop. You're not real."
Sam opened his eyes. There was nothing there. A shaky sigh worked its way from his mouth, and Sam fell back onto his pillow, trembling. Around 2 a.m, he finally drifted off to sleep. When the sun rose shortly after 6 a.m, the bedside lamp still burned brightly. 20. Wednesday, April 19th. Moore stopped at the bottom of the stairs and took a deep breath.
"Get back on track," she told herself. "Gotta push through."
Her shoes clicked softly on the glazed concrete floor as she passed under a grand arch and into the kitchen. Like the rest of her house, the kitchen was cold and sleek, all stone and metal. She opened a metal cabinet, quickly scanned the labels of the numerous high-end liquor bottles, and reached for a 30-year-old Bolvani.
"One drink to clear the cobwebs, and then you have to kick this thing's ass."
Just as her hand grasped the bottle's neck, a whisper came from the other room.
"Teresa."
Moore spun around. The archway was empty. Beyond this, a single shaft of light cut through the darkened room. For a moment, she stood perfectly still, listening. There were no sounds, save for the occasional muffled whir of a police helicopter flying over the city below. Slowly, she edged her way toward the archway.
Breathing. I can hear breathing. Someone's there.
You know who is there, her mind insisted. Fear prickled her skin like a gust of icy winter air, and the sensation enraged her. She grasped the wall of the arch for leverage and stormed into the room. The sunlight blinded her. She flinched, blinking, and held up a hand to shield her eyes. Quickly, she backed out of the shaft of light and into the shadows that clung to the edges of the room.
He's here. In the dark.
She took another few rapid steps backward and collided with something behind her. Instantly, her fists clenched as she whipped around, ready for a fight.
The wall. You ran into the wall, you pathetic, scared little girl.
She unclenched her fists and leaned in closer to the wall, peering into the shadows. Her eyes adjusted to the darkness. Something wasn't right. Reaching out, she ran a hand over the wall's surface. It was not the smooth plaster of her house. This was brick, decades old and haphazardly stacked, as if it had been constructed quickly. This was the wall in the Finch house. Moore jerked her hand away, not wanting to touch the brick for another second.
You're not really there. You're in your house in Los Angeles. You are not there.
From behind the wall, something screamed. It was faint, echoing over distance, as if past this wall were not the Hollywood Hills, but an immense, empty room. Moore backed slowly away, her entire body clenched to keep from shaking.
Go away, she ordered.
The screaming grew louder. There was a rhythm to it, a strange, uneven flow of starts and stops. It was no longer behind the wall. It was all around her.
Go away!
She roared. She blinked and the bricks were gone, replaced by the plaster wall that had always been there. Yet the sound remained. It was coming from somewhere above. Moore cocked her head, listening. It was the barking of a dog. The pit bull nearly ripped off Sam's face. Sam quickly scrambled up one of the several brick lampposts dotting the yard. The dog snapped its powerful jaws at his heels. He wouldn't be able to hold on much longer.
More! Sam called out. It's Sam McGarver, the writer! Remember we met last fall at...
His voice trailed off. Somehow saying its name made it all too real. Recognition that the house was what bound them. The dog was barking wildly, inches below his feet. Thick white spittle splattered his shoes. Sam's fingers were slipping. In another minute he would fall to the ground and have his flesh torn away in warm, bloody mouthfuls. Just that morning, Sam had thought getting on a flight from Kansas City to Los Angeles would be the most difficult part of his spur-of-the-moment adventure. Finding Moore's house wasn't a problem. Eli was easily able to obtain her address. When no one answered the buzzer at the gate, scaling the fence that surrounded the gorgeously landscaped estate also turned out to be a surprisingly effortless feat. A low, thick hedge held Sam's weight long enough for him to reach the fence's top crossbar. There was a tense moment when Sam thought he might lose his balance and impale himself on the large black spikes that dotted the fence. An image flashed through his mind of lying on the lush lawn, clutching a bloody handful of ripped scrotum while waiting for the screaming siren of the paramedics to reach him. And then he hopped to the other side, down onto the yard where he casually strolled up the steep drive toward the front door. That was when he saw the hulking pale creature round the corner, and Sam ran for cover. Sam peered over the lawn to the front porch. He took a breath and tried one more time.
More! Just let me come in! I'll explain everything!
McGarver, what the hell do you want? It was T.C. Moore, all right. That unmistakable mixture of aggression and sarcasm.
I just need to talk to you, Sam said again.
About what?
Your book!
Sam knew this wouldn't be enough to earn FaceTime with Moore. He thought for a moment, then added, "Your book about the house!" There was a pause. An eternity, it seemed, although it could not have been more than a minute or two. And then the silence was broken by the squeal of door hinges. Sam heard a whistle, and Moore called out, "Lilith!" The pit bull instantly obeyed, skulking off around to the back of the house. Moore was standing just outside the front door, her slender form draped in a sleek silk kimono. The front was loosely tied, the edges barely concealing her breasts. She was thinner than before, less toned, muscle giving way to bone. In her right hand, a pistol dangled loosely. "You've got 10 minutes, Moore announced with a stunning lack of emotion. Then she turned and marched back inside, leaving the door wide open for Sam to enter. 10 minutes would turn out to be nearly 2 weeks. But, of course, neither of them knew that at the time. Moore's house was exactly what Sam had expected. Cold, hard, purposely uncomfortable and uninviting. It was like a cinder block encased in glass, with only the breathtaking views of the city from high in the Hollywood Hills to soften the experience. As she led him through the foyer into the spacious living room, Sam took notice of the lack of clutter. It was nothing like his place. "I was wrong. I shouldn't have come here. She'll laugh me out of the house and tell me to take a flying fuck." But Moore did not laugh. She did not even offer so much as an apology, snide or otherwise, after the near mauling in her front yard. Sam had found her standing in the foyer with a tumbler of whiskey in one hand and the gun in the other. She set the revolver on the concrete counter of a nearby credenza and wandered off into the next room. They stood in Moore's cavernous living room, metal shelves running the length of the light gray walls, dark oak floors beneath their feet, a grand picture window framing the smog-shrouded city beyond. Moore stopped in front of a leather chair, but she did not sit. She stared at Sam, exhausted, black bags cupping her tired eyes like crescent moons. "What do you want, McGarver?" she asked. Sam shuffled nervously, not sure how to begin. "Tell me about the book you're writing." She gave a harsh chuckle. It sounded more exhausted than defiant. "Not a chance. You can read it with everybody else when it's finished." "How long is it?" "I don't know," Moore said. "It isn't finished." Sam pushed back. "But how long have you been working on it?" Moore stared at him curiously, not sure of Sam's endgame. Then she attempted what she obviously hoped was a dismissive shrug. "All right, I'll admit the book's gotten a bit out of hand." "When's the last time you slept?" he asked. Moore gave a long, gruff sigh, as if her chest were filled with leaves, the air rustling them as it exited her lungs. "You seriously flew all the way to L.A. to ask me how I'm sleeping?" "You know why I'm here." "I was just about to get a drink," she said. "You need a drink?" "Moore, please." She started toward the spiral staircase that led down to a walkout basement, then stopped mid-step. "What's the matter?" Sam asked. Moore shook her head, her eyes still on that staircase. "Nothing. Be right back." She disappeared into the depths of her home. Carefully, quietly, Sam rose to his feet. He quickly moved down a narrow hallway lined with framed black-and-white photographs. They were all close-up shots of men and women, a somewhat disturbing mixture of sex and violence. A split bottom lip, a penis gripped in a fist, then both wrapped in barbed wire, a knife resting on a perfect triangle of matted pubic hair. At the end of the hallway was a door. Sam reached for the knob. He carefully turned it, his heart leaping as it clicked open. He stared into the room, and his heart sank. Here it is. The mess. Unlike the rest of her house, Moore's study was a shaken jigsaw puzzle of papers and books and yellow legal pads. At the center of the storm was a desk, upon which sat a laptop computer, its screen displaying the absurdly awful image of a child staring curiously down the barrel of an assault rifle. He found several pieces of paper still in the printer. He picked up the last two pages. Under the bridge at Walnut Creek, or in the crowded basement of the house on 6th Street, she called him Pretty Boy, or Pretty Boy Tom. But when it was just the two of them alone, she called him Tommy, and he called her Charlie, his one and only. She knew he was full of shit. He was pounding plenty of strange on the side, but he always had that two-day stubble that rubbed her cheek raw, and that dumb eyebrow ring with the turquoise stone, and that same pit-stained, short-sleeved shirt that he never washed. And when he called her Charlie, her heart melted, and her pussy did backflips. Today he called her Pastor Charlie, Her Holiness. She told him it wasn't funny. He said it wasn't a joke. She was something greater now, bigger and deeper and brighter than the goddamn stars. He kissed her hard with his tobacco-stained teeth, and their tongues were mating snakes as they curled around each other.
Do it, baby. He wants you to do it.
Charlie had a hammer in her hand. A carpenter's hatchet is what Buckwood called it when he loaned it to them. Hammer on one side, hatchet on the other. Charlie's nails were painted black like that door in the Rolling Stones song. She smiled. Hey, RT, you ready to do us that solid?
Remember, you owe us, you weed-bumming bitch.
RT nodded, but then again, that's all he could do. His hands were tied at the wrist, his feet at the ankles. He was completely naked. His back was to the wall.
Play with my cock when you do it, he said.
Tommy said, It's fine, girl. I don't mind. And he meant it, because he was a stand-up guy with a job and a car and love in his heart. Charlie took RT's sad little prick in her hand and worked it up and down. Her black nails grazed his scrotum. His dick was on fire now. He wasn't going to last long.
Do it, RT moaned. Do it right when I go.
He pressed the back of his head up against the wall. Tommy whispered,
This is gonna work, right?
Charlie raised the half-hammer in one hand, blade side down. In the other hand, she felt the first wet kiss of RT's cock against her palm. Now! She slammed the blade down into his skull as his body shook. She couldn't tell if it was from the shock of the blow or the ecstasy of the orgasm. RT was a sticky, quivering mess from head to hog. It's working! Tommy slid a hand around her waist and pulled her close. It's working! The wall was opening. The first brick broke free. What the hell do you think you're doing? Moore cried as she rushed into the room. Scotch sloshed over the rims of two tumblers as she slammed them down on the desk. She snatched the pages from Sam's hand.
I'm sorry, You're fucking right you're sorry!
She shoved him hard, and his hand hit the keyboard of her laptop. The screen woke, revealing a Microsoft Word document. Several terse paragraphs filled the upper part of the page, but the cursor blinked midway down. Just as Sam's had. Blink, blink, blink. Waiting for the flood of words. Why did you stop? Sam asked after a moment of silence.
What?
Why did you stop? Moore drew in a deep breath, her heartbeat slowing, her anger subsiding.
Because some asshole was trespassing on my property,
she said. Her tone was less than convincing.
But what stopped you before that?
Moore's bottom lip trembled. Here was the truth. Here was everything she had feared for the past 6 months. She bit her trembling lip between her front teeth. McGarver, don't do this.
You've been writing since we got back, haven't you?
Like you have to? Like something is making you write?
A light flickered behind Moore's dark eyes. Across the surface of that broken pupil like the rainbow sheen of oil on water. Sam thought with a sudden sense of relief.
You're not crazy. This is happening. It's really happening.
And then relief turned to dread. You're not crazy. This is really happening.
Tell me what's going on, he said. She wrapped her arms around herself like armor. She said nothing.
When I would stop writing, Sam explained, his voice soothing and honest, I would think I was in that house again.
Her eyes flashed up to him. He had clearly struck a nerve. Sam continued,
I thought I was going crazy. I was forgetting to take my meds for depression, and at first I thought maybe it was some sort of withdrawal. So I started taking them again, but it didn't help. I even bought a carbon monoxide detector because I read that a leak could cause hallucinations. But now I know I wasn't hallucinating. And I'm not crazy. Because it's happening to you, too.
Moore clenched her jaw. She was fighting tears. Sam had never seen her so vulnerable.
It terrified him. It's happening to you, he repeated. Isn't it?
Moore stared at him intensely. And then she gave a small nod. Sam motioned to the blinking cursor on the computer screen.
But you stopped.
She sighed and picked up a few papers from a stack.
It was flowing until... Until you got to the part where someone tries to break through the wall. The wall that will unlock the house's secrets.
Her head whipped around to glare at Sam with that awful eye. He noticed for the first time that the once-shaved sides of her head had grown out. Her hair was not the stylish mane it had been. Now it was starting to resemble the world's longest mullet.
How did you know that?
Because it's exactly where I stopped, Sam said.
In the book I'm writing. The book I've been writing for the past 6 months.
Moore's eyes narrowed, scrutinizing Sam.
What's it about? She asked.
This book of yours.
There, in Moore's study, in that cinder block of a house high on a hill above Hollywood, California, Sam revealed something even his publisher didn't know. He told Moore the plot of his new novel. Not just the logline, as he usually did when asked about a new project, but the entire thing, from beginning to end, twists and turns and plot points that critics would preface with a blinking neon sign, "Spoilers ahead!" He told it all. It begins with a house. Not a Gothic mansion, but a house like any other in the middle of a small Kansas town. A family moves in, a husband, a wife, and two kids, a daughter, Alex, 15, and a son, Jake, 10. At first, everything is just fine. Dad gets a new job, Mom joins the local PTA, but something's off. Alex senses it at first, but quickly dismisses it. Jake can't shake it, though. At night, there are sounds from the wall at the end of the third-floor hallway, just past what is apparently the only room up there. A sewing room. Then things start to go south. Dad has a pretty young assistant at work, and he can't stop thinking about what it would be like to fuck her, even though his family is the most important thing in his life. Not just sleep with her, but fuck her, whether she liked it or not. Mom, a staunch pacifist, is starting to have terrifyingly vivid daydreams about brutally murdering the loudmouth rich bitch mother of one of Jake's schoolmates. And Alex, once an honor student, athlete, and all-around outgoing girl, has become reclusive. A teenage Renfield, collecting dead bugs and birds and eventually hiding something far, far worse beneath a cover of leaves in the basement. Jake senses the changes, not only in his family, but in himself. He's 10 years old, experiencing for the first time the brutal social Darwinism that will make junior high and high school a living hell. He finds himself reveling in the cruelty he can inflict on weaker kids, relishing the cheers of the popular crowd. One day, he shoves a stick into the spokes of a classmate's bicycle. The poor kid goes flying, breaking his leg, and as the cool kids watch, Jake reaches down to his fallen classmate and gives that fractured tibia a little twist, just to hear the bones grind together. It isn't really the fact that Jake enjoys doing this that scares him. It's that he knows what he's doing is completely wrong, and still he does it, as if he's standing outside of his body and watching some other kid named Jake, a stranger with his face, carry out these sadistic acts. Outside, a cloud seemed to pass in front of the sun, even though the sky had been clear and blue for miles when Sam arrived. Moore shuffled her bare feet, placing one behind the other as if she meant to run away at any moment. She gripped the edges of her kimono and pulled them tight. A darkness was creeping up behind her. A coldness had invaded the house. "So Jake begins to suspect the house," Sam continued. "He delves into its history, first uncovering what seems like a series of random mishaps involving previous owners, and then a pattern begins to emerge. Each occupant only inhabited the house for 1 year before something in their lives went terribly, inexplicably wrong. One man walked a mile barefoot in the snow just to shoot his neighbor. A son locked his little sister in an abandoned refrigerator and left her to die, gasping for breath and crying for her mother. And at the beginning of this trail of death sat one incident in particular. A man was murdered by thieves and his girlfriend strung up by her neck in the tree out front." Sam paused here, reading the recognition on Moore's face. "I know," he said. "That one sounds familiar." Moore simply gave a nod. She was, for possibly the first time in her life, speechless. Sam took a breath and continued. "Anyway, the more Jake researches the house, and the more he fights its influence, the louder those sounds grow behind the wall of the third floor hall. It's as if something is trying to get out. But he is the only one who can hear it. Then, while he's in the yard, Jake makes a startling discovery. The exterior of the house seems to extend a good 8 feet farther than the third floor hallway. He gets to thinking, what if there's a room behind that wall? So as his family falls apart around him, taken over by the evil within the house, Jake chips away at that wall, trying to gain access to the room beyond and what he hopes will be the secret to the omnipotent terror. And then there's Tommy. Tommy?" Moore said, the words little more than an exhaled breath. "He knows the power that lies behind the wall, and Tommy wants it all for himself." It seemed as if Moore had stopped breathing. She stood frozen, paler than he had ever seen her, bloodless flesh against her pitch-black hair. "It all comes to a head one night near the end of their first year in the house. The same night that Dad rapes and nearly murders his assistant. The same night that Mom follows that rich bitch mother home with the plan to bash her Botoxed brains in. The same night that Alex lures a classmate into the basement to show him the surprise that is now rotting beneath the mound of dried leaves. That night, Tommy, a local handyman in my story, slips into the house and breaks through the wall to peer into the absolute darkness on the other side." Sam's tale came to an abrupt end. At first, Moore simply stared at him, blinking, waiting for the story to continue. When it did not, she cleared her throat, readying it for the first word she would speak in a quarter of an hour. "What does he find?" she asked, her voice barely a whisper. "I don't know," Sam replied. "That's where I hit my first bout of writer's block since I'd started writing. Like inspiration slammed on the brakes and my novel skidded to a dead stop." He pointed to the screen of the laptop computer, tapping it where the cursor steadily blinked. "And I'm guessing that's where you stopped too." Moore sucked in a trembling breath. It's happening to him. For the first time in 6 months, there was someone she could talk to. Someone who might understand what she was going through. She looked into Sam's eyes and said, "I feel it too, like I'm back there, in the house. Sometimes I'm not sure I ever left." He reached out and touched her hand. She did not pull away. "I know," Sam said. "I know. Just tell him," Moore thought. "But I don't know if I trust him." a second voice said. It was the voice of a younger Moore, of a girl everyone called Teresa.
You don't have a lot of fucking options right now, do you?
Moore swallowed hard and began to describe her novel. Some of the character names were different, their backstories and relationships less family-oriented, their horrible transformations much darker and sexually perverse. But as Moore laid out her own tale, from the discovery of the house to the moment where the bite of the hammer, or in Moore's case, a hatchet, slams into a man's skull in hopes of opening that third-floor wall, she realized what Sam said was true. They were writing the exact same novel. Perhaps even more surprising than this discovery was how Moore reacted. Even she expected herself to go off into a classic Moore temper tantrum, throwing objects and expletives wildly about the cluttered room. Instead, she gave a long, deep sigh, her shoulders drooping as every muscle in her body relaxed for the first time in almost a year.
You're growing up, girl, she chided herself.
I wrote nearly 1.5 million words, she said after a prolonged yet welcome silence. 3,000 pages. I just couldn't stop. Not to answer the door or the phone, barely long enough to eat and piss. I even abandoned the book I'd been working on before we went to the Finch house. I was insane about that book before I went to Kill Creek, and then I just didn't care about it anymore. Only this story mattered. I was up to 1,200 pages, Sam admitted, angry that part of him felt this wasn't nearly enough compared to Moore's output. I was overwriting everything, and I knew it. But as long as I was writing, his voice trailed off. This is ridiculous, Moore said suddenly, crossing her arms tightly over her chest, her eyes searching the room, looking for an answer that wasn't there. I mean, we went to Kill Creek. We were inspired by it, and now we're writing about it, that's all. That's why this is happening. Sam shook his head.
I don't think so.
It's not real. It can't be real. It's a delusion.
A delusion that we're both experiencing almost 2,000 miles apart?
It's not unheard of. Moore was speaking rapidly now, anxious to find a rational explanation. There have been countless examples of mass hysteria throughout history. Nuns in the Middle Ages who suddenly began yowling like cats. A dancing plague in the 1500s. The Salem witch trials. The Mothman sightings in West Virginia. People felt compelled to do irrational things. They believed they saw things that weren't there. People who had no connection to one another. The delusions spread like diseases.
Moore could see the anger boiling up in Sam.
This is not a delusion, he cried. This is happening. This is real. No. No, I can't accept that. You don't have to accept it, Sam said. It's happening. To you, to me.
Something occurred to Moore. She looked up at Sam with a new sense of purpose.
What about the others? Maybe they're fine. Maybe it's just us.
Sam considered this for a moment, then took out his phone.
What are you doing? Moore asked.
Calling Daniel.
Sam opened his contacts and scrolled down to the S section. There it was, the phone number he had gotten from Wainwright last year. Sam tapped the number, then call. He put the phone to his ear. On the other end, it began to ring.
21. Thursday, April 20th.
Daniel sat with his palms pressed flat against his closed eyes, losing himself in the tranquility of his study. His cell phone, which had been ringing off the hook for nearly a day now, had finally fallen silent. He was thankful for this. He did not want to answer it. He did not want to be forced into mundane conversation. He could hear his wife shuffling about in the hall, her footsteps light as she passed. She wanted him to come out. He knew this, and he would in time. But not yet. Not until he cleared the unexpected hurdle before him, that blinking cursor on the computer screen, marking the moment when his story had abandoned him. In the absence of writing, Daniel had allowed his mind to wander, to imagine what it would be like when his publisher read the new manuscript. They wouldn't print it. It was too dark. Not at all the kind of self-righteous trifle to which his Christian audience was accustomed. This was no slim volume of teen-friendly carnage, served medium-rare with piping-hot sides of judgment and salvation. This was a dense work that weaved through the shadows of the soul, morally ambiguous without even the faintest glimmer of a light at the end of the tunnel. It was real. It was life. A year ago, Daniel would have scoffed at such pessimistic thoughts. That was before Claire was snatched away from him. In that moment, standing with the deputy sheriff before the house on Kill Creek, a single sentence was uttered.
"Your daughter. She's been in an accident."
And Daniel sensed something snap within him. Actually felt it break, like the dead branch of a diseased tree. And all the hope, all the peace, all the God-given calm that had once filled his heart began to drain free. Once, years ago, Daniel and Sabrina were out for a walk, their new daughter snug under a blanket in the stroller, when they came upon an apartment fire. It was an ancient six-story complex on the northeast corner of the intersection. Black plumes of smoke poured from the uppermost windows. The firefighters appeared to have the blaze under control, the powerful streams from their hoses extinguishing the flames. The residents of the building huddled on the very edge of the sidewalk. It was obvious they would not be returning home. The fire had done too much damage. Some coughed, some stood silent. Most watched the inferno with tear-streaked faces. At the far side of the group stood a mother with her son. She was not crying. She smiled warmly at the boy, raking a hand gently through his hair.
"Why are you smiling?" Daniel could not help but ask. "You've lost everything."
"I've lost nothing," she replied softly. "My son is everything. And God has spared him. God has spared us both. I have everything I need." It was a profound moment. Coupled with his safe passage through the tunnel of spiders as a child, the words of this humble woman shined a Promethean light on the dark road of life. No more. The warm glow had been extinguished. Salvation was not a blessing, but an absurd joke. Plucked cruelly away like a dollar bill at the end of a long stretch of twine. Again he heard the floorboards creak as his wife approached his office door. This time she did not move on. A moment passed, and then there came a light knock.
"Daniel?"
Sabrina called out sheepishly.
"I'm working."
"Can I open the door?"
"I'm working," he said again more forcefully.
Another pause, but her footsteps did not recede. Finally, she spoke again.
"Pastor Charlie is here."
Daniel sighed, irritated. Sabrina had threatened several times to bring their minister to the house. She had made good on that threat. Why couldn't she just leave him be?
"Daniel?"
This was a man's voice, deep and soothing.
"Daniel, why don't you open the door so we can talk about it?"
"What's there to talk about?"
"You tell me,"
the man replied. Sabrina's hands shook as she poured coffee, the lip of the pot clinking loudly against the delicate porcelain cup. Pastor Charles Norland sat perched on the edge of the couch, his hands folded humbly on his knees as if in preparation for prayer. Physically, Pastor Charlie was not an imposing figure. His dark suit hung limply from his wiry frame, the top button of his white dress shirt undone to allow tiny threads of black hair to peek through. He tanned easily, even with the majority of his days spent inside the First Lutheran Church on the corner of 6th and Walnut Streets. His skin retained the bronze sheen of summer. At 42, his hairline was finally beginning to recede, cutting a widow's peak. Pastor Charlie was 6 feet tall and no more than 160 pounds. His voice was slow yet deliberate,
understated yet powerful. Like water seeping through the fractures of a seemingly impervious boulder, Pastor Charlie's voice had a way of working its way into your very bones, until you suddenly found yourself broken open before him. Daniel waited while Pastor Charlie took a hesitant sip of the steaming coffee. He looked to Sabrina, who quickly glanced away. Pastor Charlie swallowed and asked,
"So what's going on, Daniel?"
"Nothing. I'm working on a new book."
"And do you usually lock yourself in your office for days when you're working on a book?"
Daniel shook his head. "No. But this is a different kind of book." Pastor Charlie drew in a long breath, the air whistling in his nostrils.
"You haven't been to church in quite some time, Daniel."
"Don't take it personally." A smirk played at Daniel's lips. He never used to smirk. Not before. For the next 5 minutes, Pastor Charlie backed off a bit, spinning lackadaisical tales of his congregation. How Minnie Conrad caused a bit of a stir with the church choir when she chose a pop song for her solo, Roar by Katy Perry. How 16-year-old Shelley Ellerman interrupted Charlie's Memorial Day weekend sermon by throwing up in the second pew. It seems Shelley was battling her first hangover. How the church had finally raised enough money to restore the chapel's oldest stained glass window, the one depicting Jesus' ride into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. Work should be completed by late September. Daniel felt himself being pulled bit by bit by the calm, steady sound of Pastor Charlie's voice. He glanced subtly around the room for any conceivable distraction, something to focus on in an effort to break the spell. The coffee table with its neat stacks of appropriately thick books. Charlie's shoes, recently polished black yet bearing smudges of rough leather where his rag had missed. The hump of Daniel's own belly, much smaller than it was 6 months ago, rising steadily up and down with each breath. "I'm beating it," Daniel said suddenly, interrupting the pastor's rambling. Pastor Charlie paused, confused.
"What?"
"My Dunlap syndrome." Daniel pointed to his shrunken paunch. "When your belly Dunlap over your belt." He chuckled, amused by his own cleverness. Sabrina put a hand on her husband's shoulder.
"Daniel, please."
Daniel looked to his wife's face, pained and fearful. She was going to be 38 in a couple months. She was far from old. She still resembled the pretty little wallflower he had fallen head over heels for in high school. But her eyes had aged, fine wrinkles creeping around the edges like spider webs. She looked tired. Daniel and Sabrina had been so young when they met, marrying shortly after graduation, both only 18. They didn't know it at the time, but Sabrina was already pregnant. Far from planned, the predicament had been just that at first, a situation neither was prepared to deal with. Terminating the pregnancy was not an option. Their fear and anxiety was no reason to end a life. Before they knew it, one spring day, they had a daughter. A beautiful, insanely perfect baby girl. They named her Claire, after Sabrina's mother's favorite piece of music in the whole wide world, Debussy's Claire de Lune. Daniel had hoped that their child would take after Sabrina, so he found it breathtakingly remarkable to see hints of himself in her angelic face. Then a strange thing happened. Sabrina never got pregnant again. They tried. Lord knows they tried, but it just wasn't in the cards. Claire was their miracle baby, a fateful occurrence never to be repeated. So Daniel and Sabrina put all of their love into this one child, this flawless combination of their separate souls. It was an indescribable sensation, to one moment be a parent, and the next not. If they had been able to have more children, perhaps the loss would have been easier to sustain, the pain spread over the collective shoulders of a grieving family. Instead, there was no longer a family at all. They were a couple again, as they had been in high school, as they would be when they died. No generation to carry on their name. Nothing to represent the merging of their hearts. This made Sabrina very sad, and rightfully so. But Daniel was experiencing something he had never truly known before,